KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The U.S. Senate isn't what it used to be. Political insider Ira Shapiro longs for the 1960s and 1970s, where lawmakers passed landmark civil rights legislation, debated the Vietnam War, and held Nixon accountable for Watergate. Shapiro's book, The Last Great Senate, chronicles those golden years and provides a vision for the future. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24, 2012.
My last time in Seattle was 1999, during the Battle of Seattle, so I hope this one goes a little bit better. By then, I was out of the administration, but prior to that, I had had the honor, which I was very proud of working for President Clinton and with him, and wasn't he great at the convention recently? And I really appreciated President Clinton, and he gave me the great honor of appointing me as an ambassador for my trade negotiations. And I always thank him for that because it meant a lot to me. But the truth is, I became an ambassador because of the Japanese. Basically, I was asked by Mickey Cantor, the U.S. Trade Representative, to take over negotiations with Japan in 1995. And there were some big issues coming up, and I said, well, I'm happy to do that. And the Japanese refused to meet with me because I wasn't an ambassador. They have a real sense of hierarchy, as you know. And they just kept saying, we're not going to meet with them. And finally, Cantor said, well, we'll just have to make him an ambassador. So I owe it all to the Japanese. But the thing that mattered most about being an ambassador was a family thing. My son at the time was 15. And any of you who have had teenage sons, it can be an occasionally difficult time. And he wasn't very communicative at that moment, and I was traveling a lot too much. So I tried to be with him all the time that I could, and I would drive him and his friends to soccer games and things like that. And so I'm driving them to a soccer game, and there's absolute dead silence in the car. There's nothing being said. And all of a sudden, from the back seat, a voice is heard. My dad's an ambassador. And silence. But they didn't give him a country. And I'm listening to this. I didn't know he knew that I was an ambassador, and he certainly, that distinction. But I'm still listening. More silence. But if Bill Clinton's reelected, maybe they'll give him a country. But he won't take it because I have to finish high school. And that was kind of the high spot of my ambassadorship, actually. It meant a lot to me. I'm here, thank you for coming. I'm here to talk about my book and the current Senate, my book, the current Senate, and whether these elections can possibly break the gridlock that has been paralyzing our country and obstructing progress. And I think the book brings me full circle because I actually was a summer intern in the Senate one day after college in summer of 1969. I got hooked on the Senate because I was 21. I could have been hooked on mostly anything, but fortunately, I spent the summer in the Senate. I was working for Senator Javits. It was right after graduation. It had been a terrible year or two for the country during the Vietnam War, violence in the cities. I got a vision of what I might be able to do in government. I decided not to go to graduate school. I came back to work in the Senate for 12 years. So it was a big part of my life. In 2008, during the exciting presidential election, a group of us who had worked together 30 years before in the Senate started having breakfast every month or so to talk about the race. And then we would turn ourselves talking about the Senate and how wonderful it had been when we were there and how it had become virtually unrecognizable to us. Polarized, paralyzed, dysfunctional. And I came out of one of those breakfasts, and I said, I'm going to write a book about the Senate when it was great. Now, when you do that, you've got a couple of threshold problems. Was it really great? Was it only great because I was young? Was it only great because I was there? But fortunately for me, the interviews and the research I did actually confirmed that between 1963 and 1980, America had a great Senate. Actually, I discovered something that was there that was in plain sight but hadn't been noticed. If you, I hate to say this in Seattle, but if you Google, as opposed to Bing, but if you Google or Bing the phrase Great Senate, you'll find nothing except my book. No one had noticed there was a Great Senate. You'll see Great Senate speeches, Great Senate filibusters, Great Senate buildings, but not Great Senate. But now the reviewers write things like, well, we have a terrible Senate now, but back in the 60s and 70s, we really had a great Senate. And they hadn't noticed it at the time. But in fact, it was. We had the Senate of Humphrey and Muskie, of Scoop Jackson and Jacob Javits, of Robert and Ted Kennedy, of Mike Mansfield and Sam Ervin and Bill Fulbright, Howard Baker. You go down the list, people from all over the country whose names still resonate in the nation and in their states. We had a great Senate. It was a Senate that was fundamentally different from the polarized, paralyzed, dysfunctional, degraded Senate that we have today. And it was also fundamentally different from anything that had come before it. Because throughout the 20th century, and particularly in the quarter century up to the early 60s, the Senate was a reactionary force in our country, dominated by the Southerners. At one time, eight major committees were chaired by the senators from four states. This is where I have my Rick Perry moment. Four states: Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and Arkansas. That's good. I got them all. And Robert Caro once said that the Senate was the only place where the South never lost the Civil War. It was the South's unending revenge for Gettysburg. Lyndon Johnson, famous for being the master of the Senate, dragged the Senate kicking and screaming into the 20th century with his own force of energy. But the Senate only became great, in my view, after Johnson went downtown, first as vice president and then president. And we had a progressive Senate, the Senate that started around the early 60s and then went forward. It's important to understand what made it great. Well, first, it was a progressive Senate. And you need a progressive Senate because, frankly, the Senate is set up in a way that makes action difficult. And so you needed a progressive force to overcome it. But what made it great at that time? Well, it was a progressive era. It was the era of President Kennedy and then President Johnson. It was a rare moment of peace in the beginning, a rare moment of peace, prosperity, and the efforts for social justice. But the people that were in that Senate, it was an unusual group of people. Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation doesn't need footnotes from me. But the people that came out of World War II had a commitment to the country, a sense of confidence and shared purpose, a willingness to rectify historic wrongs that they saw, particularly discrimination against black Americans. The people that fought in World War II and had been injured, some of them in World War II, didn't think the hardest thing they would ever do was cast a vote or two. So you had great people. But it wasn't just that they were great people. It was the concept of being a senator that they had and the concept of the Senate that they shared. they saw that they got this privilege of being senators, that six-year term, and usually multiple six-year terms, the ability to range wide over all the issues, domestic and foreign, and then drill deep into the ones that they really cared about. And what they figured out, they took what I call an unspoken pledge. They basically said, you've given us this privilege. We're members of political parties. We represent states. But what really matters to us is the national interest. That's what we're here for. We're here to figure out the national interest. And we'll do it through strong and extended debates, but we'll reach principled compromises, and we'll do it in a bipartisan way. And what I like to say about that Senate, which I worked in and which I've studied, it was almost a demilitarized zone where partisanship was concerned. There were huge differences ideologically and regionally, but it wasn't a partisan place. Campaigns went on, but the Senate was sort of detached from it, and the campaigns would end, and the Senate would go on governing. And when you worked for a Democrat, what they say to you was, go find a Republican if you've got an idea. The bipartisanship was deep in the grain of the Senate. And the other thing that was fundamentally important, they cared about the institution of the Senate. They started from Mike Mansfield of the majority leader's proposition. It's not the individual agendas of the senators that matter. It's the Senate that's the rock of the republic. It's the Senate that has to take collective action. And so at some point, your individual agendas got subordinated. You debated, and then you were done debating. And you either compromised or you voted up or down. And sometimes you actually lost. That's what the Senate was supposed to do. It was supposed to move the country ahead. It worked with presidents when they could, and it held presidents accountable when they couldn't. And the moral issues that they were working on, and this is a period of time, remember, when we had five presidents, none of whom served two terms. It was a period of assassination, of war, of political scandal, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford's short term, Carter's presidency. The Senate provided some ballast and some gravitas. And this state, of course, had two great senators. There may actually have never been two more powerful senators in combination than Warren Magnuson and Henry Jackson. And they represented the shift from the South to the more progressive areas of the country. And they exerted great power, but they were great legislators. And so they were very typical of that. You can't understand that Senate without understanding, in my view, the profound role of Mike Mansfield, who was the Senate Majority Leader for 16 years. And I like talking about Mansfield because the public understanding of the Senate is, well, it's a piece of crap today, but it used to work when Lyndon Johnson was there. And the truth is, it got great only under Mansfield. Johnson was a force of nature, but he abused people and he wore out his welcome. And if he hadn't gone downtown to be vice president, he would not have been very effective for very long. Mansfield built a Senate based on mutual trust and respect. It radiated out from him. He had breakfast every morning with George Aiken, a Republican of Vermont, who was his best friend. The bipartisanship radiated out from him. He kept the seniority system, but he empowered the younger senators. When Gary Hart came to the Senate, Mansfield took him aside and said, I'm putting you on the Church Committee to investigate the intelligence abuses. It's the most important thing we're doing here, but you're a good lawyer. You'll get into it. Mansfield empowered the younger people, and he managed to keep the thing going so that Mansfield was the greatest critic, one of the greatest critics intellectually of the Vietnam War. And also, after Richard Nixon won 49 states in 1972, the Senate started investigating him just weeks later. The Watergate Committee was formed on a bipartisan basis. And the reason it was formed that way was because Mansfield wanted it formed that way. And that's the way the Senate worked then.
Ira Shapiro, the author of The Last Great Senate. Shapiro spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Amina Al-Saadi recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW. 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ira Shapiro in a moment. 821 94.9 KUOW. Canadian federal officials are claiming that the geoengineers who dumped 100 tons of iron dust into the Pacific Ocean off the BC coast broke the law. Also, posters for a nude male art exhibit in Austria create a little excitement and much controversy. A food scientist says Canadians should demand more action from those responsible for the E. coli outbreak at the XL Foods beef plant in Brooks, Alberta. And journalists and politicians square off for an evening of lighthearted debate and self-deprecating humor. All these items tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows around 50. Rain this evening, decreasing after midnight. Friday highs mid to upper 50s. Showers. KUOW thanks the generous individuals and entities that provided matching challenges during our fall membership drive. They include Shelley Shermer, Ray Tufts, Chris and Deb Williams, KUOW's Board of Directors and Board of Directors alumni, and 32 anonymous Broadcasters Circle members.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ira Shapiro is an international trade lawyer. He's held senior staff positions in the U.S. Senate and served as general counsel and ambassador in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration. Shapiro first worked for the U.S. Senate a year after he graduated college. His new book is called The Last Great Senate: Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Shapiro spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24, 2012.
So, I've said there's this 18-year period, which I consider to be the Great Senate. So I get this contract. I'm getting the contract to write the book, and my publisher says, well, it sounds sort of interesting, but a couple of things. Number one, it's not a memoir. Number two, it's not political science. It's narrative history. You've got to tell a story, and frankly, we have no idea whether you can tell a story. I said, I can tell a story. I didn't know if I could tell a story. I could tell a story. I've been doing it for years. And number three, you can't write about the whole period. It's just too difficult to do. Find another way to tell the story. And so I said, I decided to tell the story through the closing years of the Great Senate. Vietnam is, civil rights legislation's on the books. Vietnam is done. Watergate is done. Nixon's gone from the scene. It's the beginning of America's third century, and there's a new outsider president, Jimmy Carter. Robert Byrd and Howard Baker become the Senate leaders. And so I come up with this idea, and my agent says to me, oh, that sounds really good. Great legislative battles of the Carter years. That'll be exciting. Everyone will want to buy that. And I said, well, we'll call it The Last Great Senate. She said, well, that's better. And the truth is, it turns out to be a good way to tell the story. It's backlit by what's happened before, and there are profiles of the great senators in it as they appear in the story. But the late 70s were a really messy period. We had economic weakness. We had foreign policy crises. The country was moving to the right. The tax revolt was sweeping in from California. The politics were deteriorating. Jimmy Carter wrote recently last year, Barack Obama faces a lot of the same problems I did, but I had one thing he didn't have. I had a Senate that worked with me. And that was a big difference. Now, I'm not going to, time doesn't permit me to tell you the whole book, but just a couple of stories to illustrate the way these people worked. It's 1977. Howard Baker, a Republican of Tennessee, has finally become the Republican leader. Very well-respected person. Wants to run for president someday. Jimmy Carter tells Baker and Robert Byrd that he wants to negotiate a new arrangement for the Panama Canal. Baker's reaction is, this was an unwelcome development. Five presidents have thought of this. Why now and why me? His staff comes to him and says, Senator, if you support that, you'll never be nominated for president by the Republican Party. And Howard Baker says, yeah, I understand that, but what's the national interest here? And Baker ends up not only supporting it, he helps spearhead it. And he gets it through. And the other person that does the same thing is Frank Church, the Democrat from Idaho, great opponent of the Vietnam War. His staff says to him, Senator, you're toast if you support this. You're up in 1980. They're out for you anyway. He says, it's consistent with everything I believe about what America should be doing in the world, vis-a-vis the third world. And they say, oh, fine. If you have to vote for it, vote for it. But whatever you do, don't be visible. He becomes the floor leader for it. That's what they did. They had courage. They had statesmanship. That's what they were there for. This is all in 1978. This is one period of time. Right after that, New York City needs financial help. They had been helped temporarily in 1975, but they come back asking for more money. And the Senate Banking Committee is chaired by William Proxmire, who's kind of an eccentric, very bright guy, total skinflint, loves talking about waste of money. He's already decided no money for New York City. The Banking Committee has decided no money for New York City. But New York says, we'd like to make our case to you. And Proxmire says, all right, you can try to make your case to me in the Senate. It's not going to be easy. I don't think you're going to be able to do it. And New York comes in with Ed Koch, the new mayor, Hugh Carey, the governor, two great urban advocates, Jacob Javits and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and they turn the Senate around. They made the arguments. You read the hearings. They assess the evidence. They really listen to it. They talk to each other about it. They turned around on it. Then, but they're still kind of concerned, all right, the taxpayers don't really want us to give this money to New York. There's a tax revolt on. We got to do it in a way that creates no precedent. And so Richard Lugar, who's a freshman senator, says, he comes up with a tough love plan, basically. He says, we'll give them the money, but under such stringent conditions, no one else will ever ask for it. And that's what happens. And New York's economic recovery began right then. And it wouldn't have happened without the Senate. And Proxmire goes to the floor. He says, he takes the floor and he says, I'm against this whole thing. But if we have to give them money, this is really being done well. And he argues one hand on the other hand. The Senate passes it. They didn't have it. People were intensely against it. There was no filibuster. There was no 60 votes. It didn't come close to getting 60 votes. But it passed because they had considered it. Last quick story involving Henry Jackson of Washington. Jackson's a very powerful senator. He becomes the chairman of the newly created Energy Committee. Jackson and Jimmy Carter just hate each other. Jackson's run against Carter. He got defeated by Carter. Carter's staff embarrassed him, abused him, basically. They laughed at him. And here's Jackson. He's the chairman of the Energy Committee. And he doesn't agree with Carter on the energy policy, particularly. He works with him, the administration, every day for years, 3 years in a row, to put in place an energy policy. He compromises because he respects the presidency even if he doesn't always respect the president. And that's the way they were at that point. Now, hopefully, at this time, you're saying, well, it sounds like a pretty interesting book, and I remember some of that political history. But we're 6 weeks or so away from a presidential election. This Senate doesn't sound anything like that Senate. What's the relevance of this book? Is it relevant at the present time? I'm glad you asked that question. Because I think it has great relevance to what's going on today. And I think it has great relevance to making Washington work again, whoever our next president is. And God willing, it'll be President Obama. It's relevant. My book is relevant to the central question of this campaign about whether the president deserves to be reelected. The question has been asked, has Obama been successful? If he hasn't been as successful as he should have been, was it weak leadership or was it something else? And the book suggests to me that it was something else. It was a form of Republican obstructionism carried out in the Senate that, in my mind, borders on unpatriotic. And the reason I say that is President Obama was elected by a clear and emphatic majority. He came to office in the worst national economic crisis of 80 years. He was entitled to believe that he would get the cooperation and the help of the United States Senate. And the minority obstructed him from day one. They offered him no help at all. Mitch McConnell's famous statement that our highest priority is denying President Obama re-election. That's not the way the system's supposed to work. We don't have a parliamentary system. Our system depends on some degree of minority cooperation and some concept of loyal opposition. But we haven't seen that happen. And so people say, was the president naive to think he could transcend partisanship? And I would say, call me naive for believing that in a national crisis, we're supposed to come together. And we didn't. They prevented the stimulus from being big enough. They demonized the health care package, even though it had a lot of Republican ideas in it. They did everything they could to obstruct financial regulation. And when I say that, Bob Corker of Tennessee worked very hard, Republican, was working very hard on financial regulation until Mitch McConnell summoned him and said, evidently you didn't get the memo. We're not trying to work something out here. We're against the whole thing. The Senate at its best. And by the way, my book is very not partisan. My epilogue is a little partisan, but it's not different, as I explain what's happened in the last 30 years, but it's not different from the way moderate Republicans feel. Alan Simpson of Wyoming said to me, the Senate changed when the battered children from the House came over, led by Trent Lott. We know what happened, basically. The Senate came back and got functional again after the 1980 election, although the 1980 election was a huge change. Great legislators from around the country were replaced by a lot of neophytes. Washington was not in that category. Magnuson was old at that time. Slade Gorton was an effective public servant, and he went on to be an effective senator. But many of the senators that came in then came with no political accomplishments and left with their record intact. But the Senate came back together in the mid to late 1980s. It was functioning pretty much like the Senate used to function. But when the 90s came, when Bill Clinton got elected, he got the same Republican obstruction that Obama has faced. We just weren't quite as conscious of it because we weren't facing as much of a national crisis. And Newt Gingrich, Trent Lott, basically, two things have happened. Number one, we entered the era known as the permanent campaign. Used to be you had a campaign, it ended, and you went on and you governed. Now we never stop for governing. The Senate's become an extension of the permanent campaign, just a battle between the parties, completely different from the Senate that I worked in and that we grew up with. The second thing is endless, endless moves by the Republican Party to the right. Every time you think they can't move further to the right, they still move further to the right. So here's why I think this is really important. I'm a committed lifelong Democrat, obviously. I passionately believe that Obama has to be reelected. I really want the Senate to remain Democratic. But fundamentally, the last few years have shown that even a Democratic Senate can be obstructed by the minority. So what I really want is for the Senate to become more like the Senate used to be, where the senators are national leaders, that they're focused on the national interest, and that they're not simply partisan operatives. Now, that's easier said than done. Basically, the question is, since I wrote about the last great Senate, which might have been the only great Senate, can there be a next great Senate? Or, more modestly, can there at least be a respectable Senate, not a degraded Senate? Frankly, it's easier at this moment to be pessimistic than optimistic. Many of you may know that Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann, two great congressional scholars, wrote a book recently which is entitled, It's Worse Than You Think. Relative to Norm and Tom, I tend to be a little more optimistic. My optimism is based on several things. First of all, I think the election is very important. I think if President Obama is elected, reelected, emphatically, that would make a difference because inevitably it would be a judgment on not only Mitt Romney, but a judgment on Republican obstruction. So I think that would be important. But the other thing that's important, I've talked to Democratic and Republican senators. Many of them are as frustrated and angry with the Senate as the public is. They don't think they were sent to Washington to be part of a diminished institution. They actually think they were sent there to try to work on the nation's problems. Now, my sympathy for them only extends so far. They seem often to feel like they're pitiful, powerless victims of this hyper-partisan Senate. And I don't accept that. I think they have the power to change it. I think they have the power to change the Senate rules as needed. I think they have the power to reject and replace two leaders that have demonstrably failed to run the Senate. Leadership matters in the Senate. Somebody said to me, you think you could have better leaders than the ones we have? I said, could you have worse leaders than the ones we have? I think Mitch McConnell is in a special category because he's raised obstruction to an art form. But I think other leaders could do a much better job in the Senate. I sometimes cite the example of Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, former governor, Republican senator, who quietly left the Republican leadership last year because he wanted to be more able to make bipartisan deals of the kind that he used to make, the kind that he grew up in. The Senate I wrote about had staff people like Lamar Alexander, like Norm Dix, like Ken Feinberg, like Stephen Breyer and Madeleine Albright. I mean, it was a magnet for people to work because we got things done and people were drawn to it. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not just talking about ancient history. We saw evidence 2 years ago in 2010 in the lame duck session that the Senate could actually work if the leader was not blindly followed. The Senate was responsible for the legislation that changed the treatment of gays and lesbians in the military. It passed because 8 Republican senators told the leader they didn't agree with him. They passed the START nuclear treaty, nuclear arms control treaty, because 13 Republicans broke with the Senate leader. They have to go back to being senators and bringing independent judgment to bear. Now, at this point, I have to say, since somebody will say it in the questions, everything has changed since the Senate I wrote about. I understand that. The demands of campaign finance, so they all fly around the country all the time and they don't really spend time there. A lobbying corps that's 5 times as big as it was 20 years ago. A shrill 24-hour media where everyone picks their own news sources. Even televised Senate. Everything has changed. The only thing that's changed for the better, in fact, is the fact that we've got some women up there. And it's not solely a men's Senate anymore. But even though everything has changed, that doesn't excuse the senators from not behaving like senators. Somebody said to me, you seem to think they should rise above the vitriolic political culture that they're in. I said, yes, that's exactly what I think. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to rise above it. And if you think it's naive to believe that, it's more realistic than any other solution that's around at the moment, other than in addition to an emphatic election that we're having. Because all of us could come up with ideas to change our political system for the better. Change the campaign finance system, change the gerrymandered congressional districts, have universal voting. You could do all kinds of things. But that'll take years, if it happens at all. It doesn't take years, actually, to change the Senate. And so that's why I try to put some of my confidence in public pressure, press pressure, and the senators' own consciences. And from my standpoint, the men and the women that are there and those that joined them in January of 2013 have an extraordinary privilege. They walk where the greats walked. They have opportunities to do things for their country, for our children, for our grandchildren. And from my standpoint, they ought to step up and do the kind of work that the senators of the past have done. And although a lot of people here are sort of looking around the room, I have a lot of sort of contemporaries here, as I said before, and a lot of them are interested in the book because they remember some of these senators. I really wrote the book for my children. I really wanted my children and their friends to know, and their generation to know, that we had a government that worked not that long ago, to try to inspire them and other people like them to make the government better. So I thank all of you for coming. I'm really glad that you all came.
Ira Shapiro, the author of The Last Great Senate. Shapiro spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Amina Al-Saadi recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ira Shapiro in a moment, 844 94.9 KUOW. A look at people reframing their ideas about what's normal. It's said that evolution results from the ability of organisms to change. But how do we tell the difference between a true sea change and a ripple in the water? Is a peacenik baboon, a man in a dress, or a cuddly fox a sign of things to come, or just a fluky outlier from the norm? And is there ever really a norm? This week's edition of Radiolab, tomorrow evening at 7. Weather outlook for tonight: lows around 50, rain this evening, decreasing after midnight. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, and showers. King County Executive Dow Constantine talks about county issues, including big agreements on the new sports arena and continuing opposition to the arena project. Also, fashion consultant, author, and media personality Stacy London talks about her book, The Truth About Style, both items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
Hi, this is Liz Jones. KUOW welcomes all the new and renewing members who took part in our recent membership drive. Thank you for making this drive so successful. When you receive your pledge reminder in the mail, please be sure to return it as soon as you can. And thanks again for all your support.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The golden age of the U.S. Senate was in the 1960s and 1970s. That's according to political insider Ira Shapiro, who longs for the days where lawmakers passed landmark civil rights legislation, debated the Vietnam War, and held Nixon accountable for Watergate. Shapiro's book, The Last Great Senate, chronicles those years and provides a vision for the future. Shapiro spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24, 2012. Next, he takes questions from the audience.
I know that you compressed the years that the book was about, but I want to go a little earlier. You were talking about that the senators from the South were all still fighting the Civil War, and they were all Democrats. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that transition to the fact that they're now all Republicans.
Obviously, you. I mean, part of the Republican Party move over a period of time is that Republicans have become a party rooted in the South, and that change has been very important. And the absence of moderate Republicans, increasing absence of it, so that Olympia Snow and Susan Collins often feel very alone, is also important. I think all those things really do matter, but I also believe that when the senators sit down and actually do their work, you find that they can collaborate on things. Barbara Boxer, one of the most liberal senators that there is, actually worked out a transportation bill with Jim Inhofe, who is a climate change denier and one of the most conservative senators. So at the committee level, you see sort of they function still. But when they get into the ultimate test, it becomes a partisan test again. But certainly the change has been very important.
Many raise the fallacious argument against what I was saying. The first 2 years, he had his way, could have had his way, with two houses majority, with a senator. And obviously, the frivolous use of filibuster makes this argument how that irrelevant. So my question is, do you see a path of changing that use of filibuster, which I think is part of what you're talking about?
I see a path by which filibusters could be made, again, rare and only in big issues. People have to actually filibuster and not just indicate that they're against something. We have a system that's evolved in a very unusual way. And I think you could change that by certain rules changes. I also think that right now we have individual holds by senators that have morphed completely out of control. Trent Lott, with whom I agree on nothing almost, in his memoir he said, when did these holds become indefinite delays for no reason at all? I think you could change that, because I think a lot of the senators are frustrated. I think you could guarantee this president or any president the ability to have his nominees considered in 90 days. And if there are too many nominees to be considered, then they shouldn't all be Senate confirmed. You ought to be able to put your government in place. I think you can make those changes. Now, I think they should have made them this year, because this year they didn't know who was going to be in the majority, who was going to be in the minority. It would have been a really good time to decide that. But I think there's a critical mass of senators who would actually like to change the way the place works. Yes.
So you referred earlier to Robert Caro's take on the Senate. In his new book, he describes how Kennedy's program was being bottled up, and it took Johnson with his personal relationships to move the Kennedy program through the Senate. Obama has said on national TV he doesn't have the relationships he needs to get his program moving. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that's true. Interestingly, I mean, look, Johnson was a genius politically and a force of nature. He also, besides his own great energy and knowledge of the Hill, he had the benefit of working on something in the aftermath of President Kennedy's assassination, where there was a sense that we want to carry forward some of the things the president was doing. So he did that masterfully, without question. He had a rare period of a couple of years in which he was able to do something. Certainly, there are things that I can think of where I didn't agree with the way President Obama handled them. But the kind of obstruction that he faced is actually somewhat new. As I said, Bill Clinton faced some of it when he became president, but it's a sort of a new thing. And I think you have to win elections emphatically. I do think you have to be tougher. But I think you have to try to summon some of these moderate to moderately conservative Republicans to sort of go back to being their best selves. John McCain, in his famous phrase, used to say, country first. And that was the way he always operated up until the election. I think that now, I think there's got to be a period of time where people rise to that level again.
Yeah. You talked about the need for change in leadership in the Senate. And you talked about the Republicans. I'm wondering if you have any comments about Harry Reid.
Well, I think we'd have to sacrifice him to make changes on both sides.
I figured that, but...
No, I mean, look. I don't think he's been a very successful leader. On the other hand, I always say he deserves respect and sympathy for the situation he's working with. I mean, Harry Reid has attempted to bring forward the legislative program with the president, and he has faced this implacable opposition. Now, there are a lot of things that I think he's done that haven't been all that impressive, but I think to some extent, as I say, I think he's a victim of the circumstances. But the Senate would work differently if you had Dick Durbin and Lamar Alexander, or Ben Cardin or Rob Portman, or even Mark Warner and Susan Collins. I mean, I can think of people who would run the Senate differently and give it a new start. One of the things that does disturb me is that despite the evidence that it's failing and the leaders are failing, I don't know of any evidence that they will be replaced. They won't step aside, and the senators will stick with good old Harry and good old Mitch, I'm afraid. And that's one reason why I think the president, in the closing weeks of this campaign, I hope he takes on Republican obstruction very clearly, so that that's part of the campaign.
I just wanted to follow up on the question of the filibuster. So on the assumption, let's say that Obama wins convincingly in the Senate, ends up something like 52-48 after the election, and it becomes clear going into the second term that McConnell is not going to change a note of his agenda and obstructionism, what do you think would be, I mean, what would be the consequences of contemplating changing the structure of the filibuster? I mean, it's a pretty serious issue, and I'm not sure without, you know, some sort of bipartisan commitment to moving things forward, it remains a very effective weapon for the Republicans. They'd be unwilling to change. If it were to change, though, what would you think would be the long-term consequences for the Senate? In fact, would it be the Senate, if the filibuster wasn't there, would this turn into another version of the House?
Well, that's why I sometimes surprise my friends by not favoring the full abolition of the filibuster. I mean, I would hate to see the Senate become exactly like the House. On the other hand,
Right now, we've got the worst of all worlds. We've got the bitter partisanship of the House and the paralyzing rules of the Senate. I do think that McConnell will have significant difficulty in being as obstructionist after the election, if Obama's elected. If the Senate is narrowly Democratic or if it's divided, I think the country won't, I don't believe the country will tolerate this kind of obstruction again. And I think part of it is you've got to defeat some of these obstructionists. I mean, people have to say, they have to translate the anger that they have toward Capitol Hill, which is held in very low regard, they have to translate it by actually defeating some of these people. They'll get the message from that.
We have time for one more question.
In some ways, I wonder how you respond to the, it looks like the House very well could become a little closer. Because it seems like the Senate is, in a way, that the Republicans are backed into a corner in the Senate, because if they don't hold out, then it would look like the House was the bad guy. You know what I mean? And so I wonder, do you see the tenor in the Senate changing much if the House becomes more of a just more of a competitive?
Yeah.
Nature of the Senate?
No, I think everything depends, well, not everything, but a lot depends on the election. I mean, an election in which the House, if the House Republicans lose seats, if the House intellectual leader, not Boehner, but actually Paul Ryan, if that ticket is rejected by the country, I think it takes quite a bit of wind out of the House. Everything depends on the election, but it also depends on the public insisting that the government work again, basically. And insisting on it, and the fact that, recognizing the fact that there are senators there that need to change their approach, and they need to sort of be, as we used to say, their best selves, rather than the selves that they've been. Anyway, I'm supposed to cut it off so you can go to the second event. Authors love to sign books, but somebody told me, I haven't been living under a rock, I understand some people even download their books, so you can do that too. But I really, it's been a wonderful audience, and I really thank you all for coming.
Ira Shapiro, the author of The Last Great Senate. Shapiro spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on September 24th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Amina Al-Sadi recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Master Builders Association Remodeled Homes Tour, featuring 21 projects throughout King and Snohomish counties. Remodelers for each project will be on site to answer questions. More information at remodeltour.com. 859 949 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Pacific Northwest residents sometimes speak of those places in their region they hope to visit one day. But in the Northwest, we often avoid those destinations because of crowds. Seattle travel writer Cray Bauer says fall is a great time to visit those iconic locations. Tourists are fewer, and as residents, it's our time to visit. Hear Cray tell why he recommends taking a fall trip to Mount St. Helens. That's tomorrow afternoon in the 2 o'clock hour. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Lind.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.